This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
Bail is refused.
You're out of order!
If it pleases the court.
To adopt this affirmation, please say the words, I do.
I do.
Nothing further from this.
Given the serious nature of this offence,
this case is dismissed.
Welcome to another episode of The Whigs. I'm your host, Jim Minns. In this episode, the barristers tackle a bill that passed the federal parliament recently and very substantially amended the part of the Criminal Code 1995 that creates crimes related to engaging in bribery in foreign countries. The Crimes Legislation Amendment, brackets Combating Foreign Bribery Bill 2023, passed the Senate on the 29th of February 2024. These laws implement Australia's international commitments to combat foreign bribery and impose substantial penalties on individuals and companies who engage in bribery while engaging in business overseas. The Whigs analyse the policy rationales for the laws, the elements and some of the defences. The discussion also touches on some recent Australian prosecutions for this conduct as well.
Welcome to The Whigs, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Jim Minns, by remote, with my kids. They may chime in. Lovely to have you here. Felicity Graham, how are you going?
Hello. I'm going well. I have a mouthful. I'm hungry.
Oh, well, I apologise. Sorry, I'm not in the studio. I can't see. There's one of them already. Stephen Lawrence, MLC.
Hey, mate.
You?
Good to be here. Really well. And you?
Very good. Living the dream. Living the dream. Manuel Kirkasharian, you in their room, sir?
I am, Jim. It's interesting. Your face appears on the screen as like red in sort of the caricature of a devilish red, and you're leaning into your phone. It's really quite...
It does look satanic.
It does, yeah. It's fabulous.
Well, that's great.
And no greetings.
No filter. Well, that's fantastic to know. On that note... I'll put myself on mute under the circumstances, and I'll throw to you, Mr. Kirkasharian.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
So the topic is foreign bribery in light of the Crimes Legislation Amendment, open brackets, Combating Foreign Bribery, close brackets, Act 2024 that the Commonwealth passed recently. Foreign bribery is what you think it is. It's bribing people.
Brown paper bags,
or
foreigners bribing Australians.
Australians bribing foreigners in the course of international business transactions. So it's got a bit of a history. I think there was an NGO pushing it, and sort of in 1997, the OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, adopted this convention on combating bribery of foreign public officials in international business transactions. Basically, the obligation is under that convention is to criminalise bribery of foreign officials, to make it a criminal offence for any person to offer, promise or give any undue pecuniary or financial advantage to a foreign public official to influence them in the performance of their duties. And I'll come to some examples of what that is in a minute. It wasn't or didn't require the criminalisation of small facilitation payments.
What does that mean?
Well, I don't know. Facilitation payments, I guess, is like small bribes, perhaps.
Like getting a licence or something it talks about.
Yeah, like if you get a licence, sometimes you have to... I mean, in some countries, it's just... I mean, some countries, bribery is the expected norm, but in some countries, it's... common to facilitate the issuing of a license by the payment of a small amount of money to the bureaucrat who's doing it.
It's getting at like a petty level of officialdom, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a sort of something that might be in the circumstance of the country ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Like everyone does it. It's at a petty level. It's not the sort of corruption that this convention and these offences are getting at.
Yeah.
Is it in circumstances where... the system might not be formalised, so you don't go into Service New South Wales and pay your $83 for, you know, your boat licence or whatever it is, but you go and pay some public official and you get the equivalent. Is that kind of an organised system?
It could be that, but I reckon it could also just be getting at circumstances where... small payments are just expected by the officials and you can't get licences unless you do it and everyone does it.
Yeah. I think your example, Flick, is sort of a morally unambiguous example. I think it also covers the more morally ambiguous ones, just when it's small fry and it's not kind of, it's not the sort of big thing that this is aiming at. And I mean, if you're talking about prosecuting people for corporations for things that happen in foreign dealings with foreigners in foreign countries, I think, you know, it's kind of limiting it to the more serious things. So in 1999, Australia introduced foreign bribery offences. The first prosecution didn't happen until about 12 years later, I think 2011.
That's interesting in and of itself, don't you think? Like, how much of a problem is it?
Well, or it's hard to enforce.
Hard to detect?
It's hard to detect. It's pretty hard to detect.
I bet a lot of it goes on.
Yeah. And the first prosecution, fascinating stuff, it's against a company, I think, called Securency's, how S-E-C-U-R-E-N-C-Y, and Note Printing Australia. These were initiated in the middle of 2011, and it was against the two companies and six individuals, and then a few more individuals were charged. But basically, the charges were relating to bribes that were paid to public officials in Indonesia, allegedly paid Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Nepal from 1999 to 2005. So that kind of tells you the lead time for investigation for matters like this. Like, it's not easy. And basically what they did was they used bribes to get foreign public officials to have the banknotes printed by Australian companies.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Okay.
Because this made the media at the time, I'm sure.
Is that the kind of technology that was, I think, created in Australia in terms of having the banknotes with the hieroglyphic thing through? Not the hieroglyphic. Yeah, do you know what I mean? What's it
the
called?
The see-through bit and the hologram.
The hologram. Hologram.
And, I mean, one wonders whether they would have got the contracts anyway because of
the merit of the product.
The technology, but, you know. So the Securency and Note Printing Australia's was sentenced in 2012 by the Victorian Supreme Court, 2012 VSC 302. They pleaded to three charges. Securency was ordered to pay a penalty of $19.8 million under the Proceeds of Crimes Act and fines of $480,000. The MPA was ordered to pay $1.9 million under the Proceeds of Crimes Act and fines totaling $450,000.
It's interesting the disparity between the kind of notional civil penalty and the criminal penalty. What's the maximum penalty?
For these things, it's enormous.
Because $480,000 or $450,000, the two criminal fines, doesn't seem that much for corporations in the context of what seems to be a substantial...
There's a totality argument though, right?
Yeah, yeah, of course, of course.
In some sense, and I think this is right, I actually think that the penalties for, like, the civil penalties are, generally speaking, always going to be higher than the criminal penalties for the same conduct.
Mm. It's just interesting, like, the corporations get fines. They obviously have capacity to pay much more than $500,000, and the individuals get jail.
Like, well, what are you going to do?
I just think it's interesting to kind of compare from a parity perspective. Obviously, you can't imprison a corporation. You can only impose a monetary penalty on them. But
you could wind it up. You could force the wind-up of a company. There are, I think, in some states in America, there are provisions that permit a court to wind up or to force sale of assets and so on. I'm not sure I think that's a wise idea. I mean, corporations have a function in our society. But...
So
the three individuals pleaded guilty. Three individuals pleaded guilty, two of whom were sentenced to 2 years and 6 months, and the third got 2 years. But they were all released on recognizance orders, effectively a suspended sentence requiring them to be of good behaviour.
So no jail time in reality.
That's right. But still, you know, it's not nothing.
Oh, it's a hefty penalty.
Although. For the amounts of money that we're talking about, maybe one might think that jail terms might have been appropriate. I don't know.
I mean, you think about what people get for Centrelink fraud.
Yeah.
You know, they get locked up for much, much lower amounts of money than this.
Yeah.
Under the federal legislation. And that's often where the moral culpability of the offender is quite low.
Yeah, but yeah, quite.
I mean, the moral culpability of some of these people's hard to assess, I think.
I think it is.
Mm, I mean, it's sort of... I remember reading this really good book over Christmas by this journalist, Radden Keefe, I think his name is, Patrick Radden Keefe.
Mm.
And he wrote he's got a book that is like a compilation of some of his big stories, but he writes about a big mining deal in Guinea for the biggest bit of iron ore that's basically left unexploited in the world. And an Israeli guy bribed the president, got real close to the president. He had a mining company, but he was not an experienced miner. But he embangled himself into the president's inner circle through the president's wife, one of the president's wives.
Mm.
And he basically stole a contract of one of the big Australian mining companies, Rio Tinto, I think, and got the contract to do it. But then that president got overthrown and then he lost the contract. And then he got convicted in Switzerland under their version of this legislation, and I think he was ultimately jailed. But lots of companies were competing for that. And it's sort of this world of dealings that's, you know, like you're dealing with the president, you're bribing the president, some other company's trying to bribe the president, not Rio Tinto, by the way.
Mm.
They were not impugned in any way. But I don't know, like assessing moral culpability in some of those environments, I don't think it's necessarily that straightforward.
No.
Hi, it's Jim here. The book Stephen is referring to is called Rogues, True Stories of Grifters, Killers, Rebels and Crooks by freelance journalist Patrick Radden Keefe, a collection of 12 New Yorker stories. The specific chapter is Buried Secrets and tells the story of Benny Steinmetz, an Israeli businessman who was ultimately sentenced to 5 years in prison for business bribery in Guinea. His appeal in the Swiss court was dismissed in 2023.
And you've got to give, I think, due allowance. There's a tension between the need for general deterrence and accepting that what we've got is the application, is the first application of a new law against people who surely, I mean, you know, may have been aware of the moral haziness of what they were doing, but probably didn't appreciate the criminality of it, you know. And
yeah,
sending
when
them
you create new laws, although
yeah,
when was it created? 1999, and this conduct in this case was 1999 to 2005. So yeah, it's basically conduct that is from the time that the law criminalised it.
Yeah, and it's novel in a sense, you know. So anyway, I mean, I wonder whether today there would be a full court press for jail. I suspect there would be. Anyway, another two people had their, I think, no, four people had their matter permanently stayed in the case of Strickland, which is a pseudonym, 2018 High Court Australia 53, and it's sort of a Lee Act 7 line of authorities where they'd been compulsory examined, the information had been disseminated to the CWP and investigators, and anyway, it's sort of off topic, but it is interesting that there was a permanent stay there.
Is there a Nauruan one that you've come across?
Not off the top of my head.
I think this is the legislation that they prosecuted the Getax company under.
Yeah.
They were alleged to have bribed very senior members of the then Nauru government to essentially sell them the remaining phosphate industry.
Right. Well, I don't know that. So the other one, the only other charge that I know about is a successful one anyway, is a case called LIFESE, LIFESE. And they were charged, there was three individuals charged with conspiracy to bribe a foreign public official. They pleaded guilty. It was a $1 million bribe to secure contracts for a construction company, LIFESE, in Iraq. And they got them through telephone intercepts, and they were sentenced to 4 years with two on the bottom. And a couple of them were fined.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, moral culpability for this sort of stuff, it kind of might ultimately go back to theories of corruption. Because I remember at uni, my arts degree, I did a subject, can't remember what the subject was called, but it was like a political economy subject. And it looked at different theories of corruption. And there's been some academic writers who've researched in this area who've kind of put the theory that, that corruption is actually good for economic development in some circumstances, that it kind of greases the wheels and lets things happen in circumstances where the state apparatus is stifling things and you need to get around these rules, basically. But then I'm sure, and I'm not endorsing that view, I'm not an expert in that area, obviously, but I'm sure there's a contrary view, which is that it's devastating in the developing world, all this corruption. So if you go around as a company from Australia and you're blackmailing and bribing and engaging in corrupt conduct in the developing world, that you're actually doing serious societal harm there.
It's kind of like a real moral position. It's like if all these foreign companies are going into developing nations and trying to bribe people, then they're just encouraging the culture of bribery to continue to exist. But, yeah, I mean, I've heard the argument that that actually it makes the wheels turn faster and that's good for the economy.
Mm.
And, I mean, I always think about the position, say, in New South Wales with ICAC, where really it's, generally speaking, for small fry bribery that gets caught up. And I say small fry, that might be $1 million here and there. But if you're an enormous corporation with access to the government and you can go in and sit in a minister's office and have your team of lawyers draft up a wonderful proposal that you hand across that gets you what you want, well, that's not illegal and it's not bribery, but crikey, you know, compared to some poor bloke who's trying to get his house built or something like that, it's an interesting...
It's anti-competitive bribery, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
In the sense that I suppose countries from places like Australia might have a surreptitious and unfair competitive advantage if they go around bribing companies and then do damage in that sense in the host country.
So can I just play this from the ABC recently?
Firstly, Australia's longest running foreign bribery case involving alleged payments to Nauruan politicians are back in court with lawyers for the company involved seeking to halt the proceedings. Back in 2020, the Australian Federal Police charged the Queensland-based company Getex with conspiracy to bribe a foreign official over payments, over allegations it paid Nauruan MPs money to further its phosphate exporting interests. Among the alleged recipients of Getex money is the current Prime Minister of Nauru, David Adiang.
He's the president,
previously
I think.
Denied the claim. Now, the company's lawyers are seeking to have the matter stayed in court because of the length of time it's taken to investigate the matter and prosecute the case. So reporter Liam Fox was in the court and he joins us this morning just to give us more of an update.
Well, it's a long, twisted and complicated story. It really came to public prominence back in 2015 when both the ABC 7:30 program and the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper reported on leaked emails and financial records from GetAx directors, the Gupta family, to Nauru MPs to get phosphate deals, to get a hold of Nauru's phosphate at cheap prices. Those leaked emails and financial records indicated money was flowing from Gupta family companies, Getax, the Getax company, to several Nauruan politicians. Now, among them, it was reported at the time, the current president of Nauru, David Adiang, and the former president, Barad Wanga. Back then, both men strongly denied those claims. Nauru was quite outraged at the time. Back then, Barad Wanga was the president and David Adiang was the justice minister. They were very angry about these reports. The AFP began investigating the case before that, around 2010. After 10 years of investigations, it laid a single charge against the Getax company, not the Gupta family, but the Getax company.
There's a lot of things that I could say about David Adiang from my time in Nauru, but given there's a trial ongoing, I probably won't.
So there's also a third one that ended up in the High Court recently, or fairly recently, by which I mean I think last year, on a reasonably interesting point about the meaning of some of the penalty provisions, about whether advantage and benefit and so on. That's the case name is the King and the Jacobs Group, 2023, High Court of Australia 23. That's another example of a foreign bribery case. the construction point, essentially the CDPP won on its understanding of the way the penalty provisions were to be read.
I was just going to say, coming back to your point, Stevie, about anti-competitive conduct, just thinking about who would be motivated to report to the authorities this type of conduct. Presumably it's competitors, right?
So I reckon it would be like competitors from either from the host country where the conducts occurred or other countries who might have been competing for the same contract.
Mm.
So that Guinea one I was talking about before, there was like three or four big international mining companies that have been circling around this iron ore deposit for years and years and years. So one of them would have a motive to report the other one under legislation like this to knock them out of it, I suppose.
Mm.
Yeah. So over the years, the OECD conducted evaluations of how the countries were implementing the convention. Australia came into some criticism. There had been ongoing attempts, I think as early as 2017, to pass some new offences. Didn't pass in 2017. I think there was maybe four or five attempts. And eventually in this year, we got the current act, which will become operative, I think, in September of this year.
So was Australia criticised for not doing enough to combat?
Yeah, that's right. Not doing enough.
Bribery?
Not doing enough to deal with foreign bribery and not prosecuting it enough. Mm. I don't know whether those criticisms were fair, but in any event, we get the current act, and perhaps the most notable thing about the current act is that it introduces a new offence that's only for corporate entities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically for corporate entities that fail to prevent foreign bribery by their associates. So associates are employees, external contractors, agents, subsidiaries, and so
fail
on.
To prevent.
Fail to prevent. Mm. Which is an interesting idea.
Well, that's probably really useful, right? Because that's to catch people who know what's going on but don't ever need to specifically engage it. You just have your in-country person.
Yeah.
You give them the money that they need to do the deal and you don't ask any more questions.
I mean, it's a pretty – in some sense, it's a facilitation of proof offence in the sense that you prove that the underlying bribe was made and you prove that they didn't have the right things in place to stop it and bingo, you've got them.
Mm.
It says that you have to have, there is a defence of having quote unquote adequate procedures in place.
Designed to prevent. So if you've got a governance structure that is designed to prevent this conduct, but you have a rogue employee, then so long as you've put in place those adequate procedures, you're not guilty as the corporation.
That's right. Although the onus is on you.
Mm.
I think it's an actual onus on you rather than an evidentiary onus.
Well, it says subsection one does not apply. So
yeah, but there's an answer. I think the legal burden. So it's a legal burden. It's not an evidentiary burden, which means you have to prove
balance
it
probabilities.
On balance of probabilities.
Yeah.
And also the offence basically provides for absolute liability for the underlying offence, so that if your associate does it, you don't need to have a state of mind about it, right? You don't have to know, you don't have to intend, you don't have to be reckless about it. It's enough that they commit the underlying offence.
And you don't have the adequate procedures in place designed to prevent it.
Yeah. So it's modelled on a UK bill or law of the same sort of thing, and the Attorney General is required by this act to publish guidance on the type of measures that are likely to constitute adequate procedures.
Mm, that's interesting.
That guidance, of course, isn't going to be legally binding, although one hopes that, and I think they will in practice, if you're giving it a good go and you get it wrong, they're not in accordance with that guidance. I think that's probably going to be enough.
Definitely a policy that, you know, could be counterproductive to charge someone if they've followed the guidance, but an associate has committed the offence in any event. Yeah. So.
Well, and I mean, it's going to be pretty powerful evidence
that you have the defence,
yep. Right? Well, the Attorney General, yeah. So,
I mean, think about a situation like this, right? You want to go and do business in some foreign country, you're dealing with someone there whose job it is to broker business deals or to help foreign companies set up. They tell you the cost of my services is $500,000, and for that I'll perform introductions that you won't be able to do, I'll get your license fees, et cetera, et cetera.
Language.
How do you know
all of that?
Well, whether 200,000 of that's actually just going to be used to bribe people.
Yeah. Well, again, you have to have
those guidelines will help you, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's not for businesses spending $1 million or $500,000. You'd hope they're doing their due diligence on that. And it's is it too much to ask for them to look behind that?
I was just thinking about Channel 7, if they found themselves looking to do business overseas. But I'm sure they've got great procedures for how they spend their money.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because on the one hand,
rogue employees.
On the one hand,
Manny's not buying.
They might say.
I'm not buying.
Anyone that gets involved in that case dies a quick death.
So I let's not go there. Don't know what you're talking about. So I just think, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I see what the legislature's aiming at. I'm not sure. I think your example is a great one, Stephen, and often that's how it's done, you know. In any event, their penalties are enormous.
Huge, aren't they?
They're huge.
$33 million per contravention to corporations.
Yeah, or the value of the benefit, or 10% of annual turnover, not profit, turnover.
If it's higher.
If it's higher.
Mm, yeah. Interesting.
So it's enormous stuff, right? The Attorney General said that he's going to model it on the UK guidance and some other guidance published by the Australian Trade Commission. This is in the second reading speech. He said that. So I guess companies, it starts in September, so companies that are doing a lot of foreign trade are going to have to be putting stuff into place right now, and I guess they already are. The law, the bill, the act makes other changes. It remakes the foreign bribery offence. It repeals and remakes it. The key changes are that the definition of advantage has been changed. So it's not just a foreign bribe to get a business advantage as it was. It can now include a personal advantage and it needn't be financial. So a good example of that might be giving someone an honour or a visa, you know.
Or accommodation or...
Yeah. Yeah.
So, flights or things like that. Yeah.
There does not have to be a foreign public official who is influenced in their official duties, nor does there have to be some particular advantage in mind. It's enough to intend to get an advantage, which is interesting because that kind of makes it almost, well, I mean, it's an inchoate offence, or it can be
an attempt almost.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, that's
right. An attempt to gain an advantage.
Well, you take steps. Yeah. That's right.
Which makes sense, right? Because a lot of this conduct will be ask no questions. You're dealing with a broker or some in-country associate.
Well, and also that, I guess, is attacking that competitive environment that you were talking about, Stephen. If, just because you don't win the bribery argument, the bribery thing that's going on with your competitors, doesn't mean you haven't committed an offence, which I guess makes sense. Foreign public officials now include candidates for office.
Okay, so if someone's running in an election campaign, it looks like they're going to become, you know, president soon or get into parliament.
Yeah.
An example of that is the opposition leader in Solomon Islands. This was widely reported. I don't think any case arose out of it, but it was revealed, I'll say allegedly, that an Australian company was paying his kids' school fees, boarding fees in Australia.
Mm.
And that's been used against him politically as essentially an allegation of corruption.
Yeah.
Hello, it's Jim Minns here. Just clarifying something Stephen has just said, the Solomon Islands politician he is referring to here is Matthew Wale. The Australian company is Allied Gold, St Barbara. The Australian Financial Review reported in 2014, quote, payments made by miners Allied Gold and St Barbara to the Solomon Islands government official are being investigated by the Australian Federal Police. Allied Gold, which was acquired by Perth-based St Barbara in 2012, allegedly provided benefits to the Solomon Islands outgoing opposition leader Matthew Wale. The companies allegedly paid for Mr. Wale's children to attend the Anglican Church Grammar School in Brisbane, with annual fees reportedly to be as much as $113,000. They also allegedly arranged employment for a relative of Mr. Wale's and other small benefits, including a $13,500 payment to Mr. Wale for, quote, office setup expenses, end quote. Allied Gold was reported to have initially benefited from the arrangement, allegedly gaining a letter confirming the legality of blasting at its Gold Ridge mine, now owned by St. Barbara, the issuance of a special prospecting license for a tenement, and the removal of certain travel restrictions. The company said it disclosed the matter to the AFP on July 30 and that it continued to cooperate with the AFP's investigation. St. Barbara declined to comment further on the issue at this time, end quote.
You can also imagine circumstances where there's a, you know, a messy kind of interface between business and politics and friendship and social circles, and what's a bribe and what's friendship. It can be a very fine line.
Well, so it used to be under the previous foreign bribery offence that the prosecution needed to show that the bribe and the business advantage were quote unquote not legitimately due. That, according to the Attorney General's second reading speech, presents challenges where bribes are concealed as legitimate payments, which is kind of, I mean, maybe not school fees, but other sorts of things where, you know, there are payments made that appear on their face to be a legitimate part of the business transaction, but are actually bribes that are going, that are siphoned off and so on.
So does that mean, for example, you're overseas trying to get a mining contract, you've got an IT company, you set up an arrangement with the Prime Minister's children for them to provide IT services that are legitimate, but you intend it as a bribe because it's a lucrative, legitimate contract. It's going to cover that, even though the payments are market value or legitimate or owed under some contract for services. Is that what that's getting at?
So that, yeah, that's a fabulous example of that, right?
It's interesting.
Interestingly, they couldn't help themselves at leaving it as improperly influencing. They provided a definition, which will be the new 70.2A of the code, Criminal Code Commonwealth, which says that the question of whether or not it was improper, whether influence is proper, is a matter of fact. And these are indictable offences, right? So they're potentially jury matters. And then it sets out things that you can't take into account in order to find, in order to determine whether it's improper, which include that it's customary. So even if the fact of a bribe is customary, can't take it into account, can't take into account official tolerance of the benefit.
In other words, if it's customary, you can't take it into account to find that it was not improper.
That's right. So they, yeah. And
Necessary or required in the situation.
Yeah.
Can't take that into account. It's a bit of a strange.
You can't take into account.
Provision, isn't it?
The trier of fact must disregard the following, one of which is if the particular business or personal advantage is relevant to proving the matters referred to in that paragraph being the paragraph that establishes the offence. If the value of the business or advantage is insignificant, that fact. So insignificant business advantages, the fact that it's insignificant can't be taken into account in determining whether or not it's improper. But then it goes on to say matters which to which regard may be had in determining whether or not influence is improper. And then there's a list, and it goes on for about a page and a half. The recipient, who the recipient was going to be, the nature of the benefit, the manner, how it was offered, whether the benefit is disproportionate to the value of any consideration provided or purported to have been provided with the benefit, which the intersection between that and the insignificance of the value is interesting, whether the benefit was made or offered dishonestly, whether there were accurate records kept, and so on. And really what they've done is all the arguments that a prosecutor might make to support the proposition that, you know, the influence was improper, the legislature has decided to set out in a long list. I hate that kind of drafting. I hate that Parliament can't resist telling courts and juries how to think about things. This is all stuff that really could have been left to the court. But here we are. There's 10 years max for that offence. And beyond that, there were some amendments to the tax provisions arising where circumstances of foreign bribery. Basically, you can't claim your foreign bribes as tax deductions, and some other sorts of things. Do you know, I think I'm told, I don't know whether this is true, but someone once told me that there was a time where you could put in your tax return, say, if you were a drug dealer.
I remember that. I remember this. This is true.
Is this true? This is so true. You could put in your tax return if you're a drug dealer. You could claim your legitimate business expenses.
Fines.
Fines as well?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Really? Mm. But think like the expenses, the bags, the depreciation on the scales, right?
Paying for the lawyers to defend you?
Well, I don't know. But no. So you could put that in the tax office.
Can't earn money if you're in the clink.
With your check to paying the tax that you owe for the profit that you've made.
And off the drugs.
Off the drugs. And they wouldn't do a thing about it. And that was it. Right?
Hi, it's Jim here again. Stephen and Manny seem to be referring to Commissioner of Taxation versus La Rosa, a 2003 decision of the full court of the Federal Court of Australia, which upheld earlier rulings that Frank La Rosa, a convicted heroin dealer, was entitled to a tax deduction of $220,000 for money stolen during a drug deal. As a result of the decision, the federal government amended the Income Tax Assessment Act in 1997 to prevent similar deductions being made.
I mean, something this... I don't know about the morality of it, but the information sharing is interesting because you are compelled to speak to the tax department or it's a crime. So it's in some sense it's a...
I did a tax case just before I left the bar.
Yeah.
And I looked at all those provisions.
You haven't left the bar.
Protections, etc. Well, I've actually just renewed my practicing certificate.
Right.
Yeah, because I didn't renew it initially and I thought, oh, I don't want it to not have it for this financial year.
Yeah.
So I've got continuity. It's a massive hassle to get a new practicing certificate
after having
if you've let it lapse.
Yeah, sure.
It's a real, I had to start the whole thing again.
Anyway, that's really all I wanted to say about foreign bribery, except to say that big corporations will be having a lot of work to do, those who engage.
Or the consultancy firms will have a lot of work to do about what governance structures these big corporations should be put in place.
And the naughty ones will have a lot of work structuring their affairs to get around these laws.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the big law firms will have a lot of work to do. I hope they engage some criminal lawyers to give them some advice on how these provisions work, which I'm sure they will. Mm. And, yeah,
interesting.
Hey, just while we're rewinding about 30 minutes ago, talking about a case that may or may not be floating around, lots of commentary about the Harman undertaking lately. Anyone else picked up on that?
Thanks,
Wiggs.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
We popularised that.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Wigs to cap off. It's the third wig of the month, which means it's fun things. I think that's the order it goes in. Thank you, Leo. Felicity Graham, what's your fun thing?
My fun thing is that I am... Sorry, I'm just doing a Stephen Lawrence looking at my
These guys are looking at... Have we done a fun things this year?
I don't
think we have. I've done so many fun...
I don't think so.
While these guys are looking up their diaries, I've done so many fun things this year. I jumped out of a plane.
Well, Manny, you're first. That's ahead.
I jumped out of a plane, which was absolutely amazing, and I didn't find frightening, which I'm told
you
is...
You didn't?
No, I didn't.
Are you serious?
I didn't.
And did I'm you told do it with Higgins?
No, I haven't. Higgins, I haven't seen him since I've done it. But somebody told me if you do it and you don't find it frightening, you're hooked.
Mm.
And I loved it, man. It was
Did you feel
fun.
A sense of terror at the height at all?
No. So, yeah. Let's not overstate it. There was fear, but I wasn't like overwhelmed with, it's like, okay, I'm pretty high. I'm first time out of a plane. And when the wind hit me, it was like, okay, I'm a little thrown by this. But then I was just like, wow, man, this is amazing.
And how long did you have in the air before landing? Were you just sort of free-falling or whatever?
There was a fair bit. I was free-falling towards clouds as well.
Yeah.
Wow. So like really thick cloud cover. I saw a rainbow on the top of the cloud that was a perfect circle, which was fascinating. And then kind of floated down through. Anyway, it was amazing. So anyway.
So did you take any substances before you did this?
I did not. But can I tell you, when I got
hydration.
To
hydration.
When I
I saw rainbows on top of rainbow. Clouds.
When I got, well, I was sort of driving back and I just kind of out of nowhere just screamed like, woo! Like I was so happy. So this rush of realization that I jumped 10,000 meters and didn't die. 10,000 feet and didn't die.
So. I've got a good segue as, from that.
Yeah.
My fun thing is I went in a helicopter in the Kosciuszko National Park.
Oh, amazing.
Did you look at all the Brumbies, the wild Brumbies?
Yeah, so I'm on this inquiry in relation to the aerial culling of Brumbies.
Yeah. So I paid for this flight. Is that
you all paid for this flight? Correct. Oh, so it was a National Parks and Wildlife helicopter.
Yeah.
But we got a flight down to Cooma, then we got a bus into the park.
Yeah.
And then they split us up into two groups and we had like a 40-minute helicopter trip around the park, which is beautiful.
I love going in helicopters. Kosciuszko
is so beautiful.
Mate, I went hiking there about 3 weeks ago.
Did you? Yeah.
I had to get rescued once by helicopter in Kosciuszko.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a big park. It's the size of Bali.
Is it?
The whole, there's more than one park, I think. Yeah. But the whole area that this horse issue is an issue in is the size of Bali.
Yeah. What's your fun thing?
My fun thing is that I have just finished a trial.
That's not fun.
Woohoo!
And
yes.
Cleared my diary for a little bit. Okay. Because.
What about buying two pizzas and bringing them today? Two lunches?
Well, I noticed you were gobbling on a lot of that during that.
That's true.
Recording.
Yeah, insulting.
You're about to go again.
Am I going to hear that when I edit it?
Hear what?
The munching, probably.
Yeah.
He did try to move the microphone away, but.
No, I moved the microphone away.
Don't worry about it.
Not with your mouth, not with your head tilt. Just.
What about you, Jim? What's your fun thing?
No, I need to think of a better fun thing.
My fun thing now is just counting down the minutes till the week's episode ends.
Because, all right, man.
That's a lot. All right, we'll. Anyway, Manny's and I make up for it.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm.
No, so. Manny was amazing, Manny. All hail Manny.
Bless.
What a trip.
Bless.
Good on ya.
What a trip. Quite. All right.
Hi. Adios, Wigs. Adios, audience. Adios. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next month.
Wigs bye. Out.
Thanks for listening. Please like The Wigs on Facebook at The Wigs Podcast. Don't forget to rate and review on iTunes.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, produced by Jim Mintz.